You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest this morning on the Made of Clay Report is David Hopkins. Welcome, David. So it's good to have you here this morning.
Well, it's good to be here, too. Thank you.
Yes. And the way we usually start these interviews is with a thumbnail sketch. You know, who are you? Just paint a broad stroke picture.
Well, I'm a beekeeper. I'm a back-to-the-land farmer. And I am active in social circles as much as I can around town, playing music, and I'm involved in various initiatives regarding environmental protection. A lot of it is focused around the health and happiness of our friend, the honeybee.
And we're going to hear more about the health and protection of the honeybee later. I know that's a big part of your life, and you travel out to the Midwest and different places to pursue that, right?
Yes, I do. Yes,
and,
I do.
But right now, you're also a musician, and you are, as you had said, and this is our first show where we're doing live music with the guests. We've had guests bring their music on CD or by other means on their iPod, but this time today, we are doing live music for the first time. So take it away.
Well, thank you. It's exciting for me. I've been writing poetry since I was a child, and I've been playing music since I was a child. So it seemed a natural opportunity for me to perform some of my music. It's one thing that I like to do. So I have a song that is currently being used as an introductory tune. The tune itself is one that I stole. I think it's a tune called something about being a cowboy. I forget exactly, but I play it in the key of F. I'm an old farmhand. I was born on the plains in Lincoln, in Nebraska. And we went right back to old Fort Hays. And now I spend my days just singing about my story. The more I sing, the less I worry. I say yippee-i-o, yippee-i-ki-yay, yippee-i-o-ki-yay. When I was born on the plains, I was very young. Took quite a while before I learned my name, and a while longer before I knew my song. But now I'm getting older, things are looking better, and the autumn is coming, I better wash up my old sweater. Say yippee-i-o, yippee-i-ki-yay, yippee-i-o-ki-yay. I knew a girl named Pearl, growing up on the farm. Back in it was a big old world, just going out to the barn. And now I ride the Amtrak train from a coast to coast. I hit the superliner diner for eggs and toast, singing yippee-i-o, yippee-i-ki-yay, yippee-i-o-ki-yay. Coming into town, a woman on my mind. I'd like to dance with everybody, I'd like to dance all night until the morning comes and the sunshine lights up the sky. I'll still be singing songs with my sweet honey pie. Yippee-i-o, yippee-ki-yay, yippee-i-o. Like a good time, a song with my friends. I like to make up rhymes, and I like to hear that clarinet solo one more time again. I like to sing a song about a turtle in a girdle, and I like to sing along with the people in a circle. I say yippee-i-o, yippee-ki-yay, yippee-i-o-ki-yay. If it's a simple song, I can jam it with you, 'cause I like to play along and add a verse or two. Now, the
music sounds so sweet when the clarinet makes a move and people tap their feet and the band finds a groove. Yippee-i-o, yippee-ki-yay, yippee-i-o, ki-yay, yippee-i-o.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and David Hopkins is our guest this morning, and this was Yippee-I-O Kaye, one of his own songs. And thank you, David, for that song. That is a powerful piece of yourself, but also it's inviting people into making the song with you.
That's right.
And that's a skill that we don't often have in this culture of possessivism. You know what I mean?
I understand.
So tell me, we're gonna be playing around with sound levels and stuff as we try to find the ones that work the best. What experience, you know, what is the major life experience that helped you to, quote, find your name from the song and also to find a way to travel through this world with integrity?
Well, I think finding out who I am has got a whole lot to do with where I come from and what things were like when I was a child.
So tell me.
Well, I'm old enough now so that I remember life in the 50s, and I think I was able to touch the American culture when agriculture was primary. I really appreciate that, and in my lifetime I've seen that change. Mm-hmm. During my childhood in the 50s and 60s, I really appreciated my grandparents, and I'm still amazed that through my grandparents I was able to touch the life in the 1800s, and especially my older beekeeping grandfather, who was born about the time of the Civil War. And I think that's phenomenal. I've got real life experience that touches back. That wasn't that far mm-hmm. ago, I guess. That wasn't that long ago. And then I began to come of age in the 60s, and that was also formative days. And I opened my eyes to issues of the day, civil rights, and I started to explore things like nonviolent aggression and the practicality of warfare and the necessity of warfare that seemed to be so constant. Mm-hmm. And with Vietnam in the news, I certainly began to question those things. And so it was all those experiences that formed me in all kinds of different ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm gonna point out a couple. Where in the Midwest did you say you were from?
Well, I was born in Lincoln, Nebraska, and yep. raised in western Kansas, where our family had a small farm that was in the generations for years. And at the age of 10, we moved to central Minnesota, where I grew up a little bit more and graduated from high school, and then I blasted off from there.
Right, right. Well, just a little bit of history. The 50s were a tough time for small farmers in this country. The rest of the country, urban areas, were taken off, but the farmers were getting beaten by droughts and low prices because their productivity drove the prices down, which drove a lot of small farmers out.
Right.
Given the nature of the production. But I, too, grew up in King City, Missouri, which is just 30 miles from Iowa and Nebraska and Kansas, up in the corner. And but I'm about 10 years younger than you are, quite 10 years. And I grew up in the supervising or the sheltering of people who were born in the 1880s, 90s, and early 1900s when my dad died. These were the people who were my parents' generation, their parents, my grandparents' generation and older. And that's a different perspective on life, and I know what you're talking about. It's a very different perspective, and a very different perspective on farming and the land.
It is. Things have changed in many ways. There's feedback in here.
Okay, so we're gonna turn this down back a little. I caught a little bit of it just then, okay?
Right.
So is that better now?
Yeah, that's better. Yeah.
Still some, though?
It's not as loud, but it's less feedback.
Okay, so have we got it? Yeah. Okay, so maybe I'll also stay a little bit further away, because when I get closer, things get louder on this end. So And if you hadn't, this is WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is live with our first studio musician guest for this series. So, David, what did you, you said you used a term that's almost would be considered not quite appropriate, nonviolent aggression. I see those two going together very closely, but a lot of people don't necessarily see aggressiveness and nonviolence in the same concept.
Well, I guess you're right. There's a whole spectrum of violence, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I'm really talking about the most obtuse violence. I think people can be aggressive without being violent. But I really question the use of violence by military powers and the obtuse violence. I do think that that when we fine-tune the practice of violence, we can clean things up beyond the physical destruction. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But that's really where my big focus is the physical destruction. Although I understand there's interpersonal mental destructions that can be done too.
Right.
Really began to question the use of military force. Mm-hmm. And I talk about aggression with the concept of defense, where I believe there may be some exceptions for the use of violence, although I continue wrestling with these things.
Yeah. And if you live with your hands and you live with the land, if you live with your hands and you live with the land, then you kind of understand that there are acts that cause damage, but they're also restorative, potentially. Yeah, so these are concepts that a lot of people who haven't experienced hard physical labor in engagement in a dance with a contrary piece of ground or a contrary piece of earth or a blessed piece of earth that you don't understand. A lot of people don't understand the physical relationship. How did you discover that quality of life?
I have to admit that I only heard bits and pieces of that commentary.
Okay. So we're trying to figure out how to... Okay. Yes, okay, I was bringing my mic. Okay, so what I was saying was that we need to... A lot of people don't understand that we have a profoundly physical relationship with the land. One of my guests was a field biologist who said anybody who wants to live on this earth should either slaughter a big large game animal and eat it, or they should, if they're a vegetarian, they should clear 1 acre of land so their vegetables could be raised, and in the process they'll see what damage and what violence they do, and they'll have to become accountable for it and working with it in a more humble way. And a lot of people don't have an occasion to learn those lessons, and you did. And how did you come to learn that kind of physical relationship with reality where you have to do things that are powerful but also edgy?
Yeah, this is a work in progress. It continues to this day. I guess I could work back from the current when we're out on the farm. We're wrestling with the concepts of killing mice and chipmunks.
Right.
And the idea of doing that ethically, this is a constant conundrum for us. And same thing with carpenter bees that get into the house. Mm-hmm.
They can destroy a place. Yeah.
And kill them. Even the honeybees from our own hives, when they are pestiferous and just coming in out of the blue and bugging somebody in the garden or on the deck, in my eyes, they are eligible for execution.
Uh-huh.
And so I do, but it involves this constant kind of mental work to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. You have more music. What would you like to cut to next?
I do. Let's see. Let's go to Bob Dylan's Revisit.
Okay.
When I was living in Minnesota, I settled in the area of Duluth, and it was very poignant to me because that was the birthplace of Bob Dylan.
And as soon as I began to learn how to spell the word blues and became interested in folk music, I was enamored by Bob Dylan, who was playing in Minneapolis at the time. I began to collect his albums, and I followed that guy's music and his poetry, and then he got away from me. He's so prolific. By the late 1990s, he made a rare visit to Duluth, where he played a 4th of July concert, split the bill with Paul Simon and the Graceland Band, and it was a fantastic time. A friend of mine penned some lyrics, and he said, "Let's make a song about this." And so we did. There was a fog on the lake, rain soaked the ground, when Simon and Dylan brought their music to town. We lined up for a mile when we came to the door, to hear the sounds of silence and the masters of war. And there were thousands of faces smiling with joy. There was something going on for a hometown boy. One man was sober, he looked at the rest. He says, "I've been here since morning now. How's that for a test?" Well, when the music began, Graceland was jamming. The people on the sidewalk got tired of the cramming and ran through the gate, pushed the fence down, just dancing in the mud while music filled the town. Bobby says, "I was born up on that hill. I'm glad it's still there. Do you like my band? Do you think that I care?" But he sang with a smile till he was done, while the rain and the fog covered Highway 61. Highway 61 goes by my baby's door like a rolling stone. Come you masters of war, a message is pulsing, it's thick in my blood. Bobby, may you stay forever young. He says, "I was born on that hill. I'm glad it's still there. Do you like my band? And do you think that I care?" With a smile he sang till he was done, while the rain and the fog cover Highway 61.
And you're listening to David Hopkins at performing live his own music and music he's written with friends. And this is the Made of Clay Report on WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. So, David, when you look back at those years coming out of Kansas and Nebraska and Minnesota, you know, what brought you here? How did you end up here from there? And what's changed in your life since you've been here?
Well, my beloved spousal partner and I are both late bloomers. Got our degrees in our 50s, and then we went on a job hunt and decided whoever gets the first professional job, that's where we'll go.
Mm-hmm.
It was a long job hunt, took a while. Pretty soon Carla found Ithaca College with an opening that was a perfect fit for an art professor and an art education educator. And so she came out here, gave it a one-year test drive, and decided it was a keeper. And she started work on her tenure file. I started work on selling our home in Duluth. And despite the tremendous market problems of the day, it sold. And so I followed along, and that's what started our life in New York.
How long have you been here?
This is our fifth. Yeah. Carla's sixth.
Yes. So she came right at the kind of in the middle of the downturn, the economic downturn.
I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It started in 2007. It was hitting hard in 2008. So yeah.
It was hard to find a job.
Yeah.
And we constantly wondered about ageism in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's true, it added to the difficulty. But right. Anyway, here we are, and we're very happy. Carla now has tenure, and we're really settled into a nice little farm and all of that.
Great, great. So what did you say you're late bloomers, and what do you mean by that?
Well, I was 53 years old when I started going to college and began to peck away at my bachelor's.
Mm-hmm.
Simultaneously, Carla got her MFA. She had taken time off to raise her daughter and to teach in the elementary situation. And her daughter actually went to college. The year that we all graduated, we had one big graduation party for the three of us.
Uh-huh. That's great. That's great. And why is education a late blooming thing for you? You had a life. You had a good life, I imagine, before that. Why do you call it late blooming?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's constantly blooming, isn't it? Yeah. It's late blooming in terms of going to college and looking for a professional career.
So the job brought you to Ithaca, and now you're finding a place here.
Right. It's such a lovely area. It's really beautiful for agriculture, especially by contrast with Duluth, Minnesota, where I've seen freezing and snow every month of the year. So when we arrived here, put my first garden in the first part of September, beat back a bunch of weeds, and actually had fruit from the zucchini that I planted before the frost came, and I was enamored by life in the tropics and the amazing things that we can grow here.
Yeah, you bring a perspective to Ithaca that most people don't. They see it as cold and forbidding, and you see it as opening and tropical.
Right.
And that is a healthy leavening perspective. Yeah. So you've talked about bees. You've talked about how did you get connected to beekeeping?
Well, the beginnings of beekeeping are in my childhood and my love and admiration for my grandfather, who was a beekeeper. And then as a child, I was a 4-H guy. And I don't know why I didn't start keeping honeybees during those days. It strikes me as kind of odd, but I was collecting butterflies and doing demonstrations for the fair and all of that sort of thing. By the age of, in my early 20s sometime, I got a hive of bees. And for most of the years since then, I've had bees. There have been a few years without, but primarily I started keeping bees in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with your bees here? Where do you take them? Where do you place them? Do you sell them, rent them out, or how does your bee work?
Right. I have just loved providing honey for our family for all of these years, and now that I'm looking at an unpensioned retirement where I need to work through my retirement, it seems like honeybees is a good answer for me to either make a little money or lose a little money. I'm not sure which sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But we started growing our holdings and hope to have enough to sell some beyond the family soon.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got four different bee yards. Each one has about a dozen hives of bees in it. Up north near Aurora, there's a farm where they host some of my bees, and also near Sherwood, there are a few bees over there on a friend's property where he and I are actually partners in that apiary. And I have a yard of bees near Danby and a yard of bees in my backyard.
And the production is just beginning to get above your own consumption levels?
It's beginning, yeah. We've been focusing on raising bees so much that we haven't really raised much honey. But now I think we're hitting a level so that we can start producing honey and start focusing on that now instead of raising bees and building equipment.
Right, right. And what is we've heard so much over the years about the damage done to the honeybees from different, you know, pesticide, or their curiosity about what the issues are behind the dieback.
Well, it's alarming to see the population continuing to decline year after year, although there's other factors besides honeybee health. But during these last few decades, I think honeybee health is really strongly part of the honeybee population decline. Right now, there's about half as many managed colonies in the United States as there were when I started. And about, I think it was 2006, there was the report of a new phenomenon called colony collapse disorder, where the bees just disappeared in mass. And so a lot of research has gone into that. And of course, being as dramatic as it is, it really hit the headlines. The research has been looking into the decline of honeybees and revealing 60-some factors that contribute to colony collapse disorder. So now, as we learn more and more of the specifics about it, I think the term colony collapse disorder, CCD, is about done. Initially, the meaning of that was mysterious. It was a term for something going on that was mysterious. But now the mystery is being unraveled.
But 60 causes, that's still an enormous amount of stuff to account for.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It includes everything from the style of agribusiness and the loss of habitat to the change of habitat from natives to domestics, from the to the feeding practices, changing from supplemental feeding from corn syrup or cane sugar to corn syrup,
right,
and especially high fructose corn syrup, and the presence of parasites that transmit some deadly viral diseases. These are being discovered and explored. New varieties of fungal infestations, etc., etc. Honeybee health is getting to be so complex that now it's advised for beekeepers to have a microscope in their toolkit.
Wow. My, maybe you can help me understand something. My father was not a beekeeper per se, but he had the equipment to go into the woods to harvest honey from one of the many bee colonies that were in the dead or hollow trees or whatever else they had where they were, and he would harvest honey periodically, and he knew where he could do it, and he knew how to do it without getting totally stung. That kind of foraging for honey, was that ever very much part of the honeybee production system, or was that, we were basically a subsistence farm. You know, we raised essentially everything we ate, from meat and fish up through vegetables and fruits and even honey. So,
I think honey hunting is an ancient thing, and I know that it persists to this day. But the development of honeybees really took the need away, I guess.
Right. Well, he had he was working on about 150 acres of forest, so he had that was penetrated by fields. So he had space to kind of do that maybe didn't. And he also chose to live a life that was much more simple and much more less technology driven. He tried to use some pesticides back in the 50s, but when he saw what they did to the critters in the ground, he quit after two or three seasons and never did that again. He plowed the fields on the contour so he would cut down the erosion, but he never really took to the high-tech ways of farming. He died in 1966 when I was 7, almost 8, so I didn't get to learn from him, but he learned most of those techniques from people who were born in the 1880s and 1890s, who he emulated.
Yeah, he was probably a beeliner.
A beeliner.
He probably had the equipment and the know-how to to triangulate the flight of the honeybees to locate where the swarm was located.
I would not surprise me. He could track animals. He could follow all sorts of critters. He had a very keen observation sense. Anyway, I don't want to. I just was wondering if the natural kind of harvesting. What did you call foraging for honey? Made sense. So,
and sometimes that comes up today too. People have a swarm that settles into an unwanted place, a house or a mm-hmm. barn or
right.
a post
right.
office. Once I removed a hive from a post office. Another time I removed a swarm from an old house that had balloon framing, and so there were combs in it that were 16 feet long.
Holy cow.
And it was just an amazing thing. It was a huge tub of honey that came home, a huge tub of wax, and a big colony of bees put into hive bodies that became very productive in the bee yard.
Mm-hmm.
They were tearing that house down, and there was this little old man roaming around watching us work and kind of muttering about how we're going to miss those bees. Oh, they were so nice. Sometimes the honey would come through the wallflower, you know, it's the wallpaper. But say, you know, those bees were here when I first come a-courting my missus.
Yeah.
So we figured they were there for some 75 years or more.
Yeah,
it was a phenomenal thing.
Yeah, people used to live with what they didn't feel like they had to change.
That's right.
And we don't have that sense of accommodation so much anymore.
Right.
Right.
When I first got to Ithaca, some people in Jacksonville asked to have honeybees removed from one of their porch columns, and it was the same thing. Oh, we're going to miss those bees so much. And I said, well, we can set them up in a hive in your backyard, and you can have them out there where they won't be a trouble. And they said, no, you go ahead and take them, but we're going to miss them.
Yeah. Fondness, but a little faint of heart.
That's right.
Yeah. So why don't you pick up your next song, and I'm going to do the station ID. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on the Made of Clay Report is David Hopkins. And David, what are we going to listen to next?
This song is called The Full Moon. It's a song that comes out of some of my days in Duluth, Minnesota. Really a beautiful place on the other end of the Great Lakes, on the farthest west part of Lake Superior. It's a seaport, believe it or not. It's an inland sea. If we're in the Finger Lakes of the Great Lakes Basin, that would be the Big Toe. Divine. I heard a soft refrain, and I was thinking about my lover when the moon is full, shining over the sea. And there's a rhythm in the tidal pulse when I close my eyes and dream. Among a white pine, while the moon grows full, are we watching the moon together? I feel drawn by her pull. Will you come with me and hold my hand? We'll walk along the beach together. I want to hear the song in your voice telling me everything that you wrote in your letter. Well, sometimes, you know, it seemed like forever since the summer nights were steaming. Now I curl myself in my blankets while the autumn wind whispers round freezing. And the nighthawks are flying sound. Hummingbirds have left the flowers. Gardens fill the harvest kitchens. And darkness lingers for hours. I watch the moon every evening. Since the dark of the moon and every night, you know the moon grows fuller. I believe I'll see you soon, because you
face is lovely, lovely in the moonlight. And there's a magic when the moon is full, and in the moon your eyes shine. When the moon is full, I do believe there's some magic when the moon is full. Do you believe like I believe there's a magic when the moon is full?
Our guest is David Hopkins, and this is the Made of Clay Report. David, your music is great. How did music come into your life? How have you taken it? What is it for you?
My parents were good to me, and I wish everybody could do the same for their children and put them at piano lessons when they're 5 years old. And that just gave me a great love of music and an understanding of music with a visual of the keyboard. And then from there, they let me follow my bliss into playing recorders with the fourth grade class and having violin lessons a little later on. And then in high school, it was into the brass. And that's where I first picked up the tuba. And I continue to play the tuba today. But I think it just really comes from a lot of parental nurturing and just allowing the natural flow.
Mm-hmm. And what I hear is you played out of bliss. I had a son who picked up the violin and had a teacher who just said, play it for 20 seconds, pick it up, and when you have something in your ear or in your heart, just play it and then put it down and do that 20 times a day and you'll learn all you need to know. And then she didn't get tenure in the system, and they came in with a new teacher with more rigid expectations, and he gave it up because he couldn't kind of take that kind of discipline. But it sounds like you play when you feel it.
I do, and I guess I've had some good guidance that way. Your story reminds me of a guitar mentor I had who said, just play that thing. Just pick it up while you're kicking back, watching a video or something, and play a scale. Just put your fingers on the neck. Mm-hmm. Just anything, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what is it? Why do you write? I mean, you could play music forever and just do covers of other people's stuff, but why do you write music?
Well, I wish I had a little more understanding into those why questions. I pretty much just let it flow.
It's a fair answer.
And I know that it's been a lifelong interest to write stories and to write poetry and to write lists and do those kinds of things, and so I just kind of do what I want, I guess.
But you're documenting it for yourself? Is it the art that you make for yourself? Is it the art that you make for your honey? Is it the art that you, I mean, with all puns intended with honey.
Yeah.
Is it the art that you make for the people around you?
I enjoy sharing my art. That's for sure. I enjoy sharing music. I love it when people dance. Mm-hmm. I love it when people come together around music, so there's definitely a social factor. When people cock their ears and pay attention to it, then I'm really motivated to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more than just going into the hermitage and satisfying myself, mm-hmm, with music or writing.
Yep. You also have another role in life, your work. You know, it's work, and you work at First Baptist Church as a janitor.
I do.
And you wrote about that experience, a line which I am heartened by the meaningful, not mundane, janitorial work with First Baptist congregation. And that was one of the summary lines of an essay on what it means to take care of the place in terms of making it eco-friendly and not wasting a lot and not throwing a lot out. How did you find yourself in that role?
They advertised on Craigslist that they had an opening for a janitor right away when I got here in New York. And I wanted to be able to plug into the community somehow.
Yep.
And I thought that would be a wonderful way to do it. It's a church that I had admired the building and the location of, and had heard a little something about their progressive legacy. And so I responded to that and was given the job. And it does seem like being a janitor is mundane, but it gave me a place in the community. I've got some social standing, being a janitor with them. As it turns out, the people are wonderful, warm, open-minded people who respect me greatly for my work, and give me great latitude as far as determining my schedule and everything that I do around there. And so I think it was more to find a place in the community than anything.
And that community, I think you've said it well. There are communities in Ithaca where, as a janitor, you would not find your place other than in a social pecking order. But true. In that community, you can be taken seriously because the ethos there is one of the equality of all people, the priesthood of all believers. And believers doesn't mean you're a Christian. It means you are one seeking right belief and right ways. And that's a powerful, powerful place to be. It also harkens from your telling of your story to the Midwest, where economic class and status among farmers oftentimes and their organizations and institutions was not so sharply drawn as it was out here in the East. What we would call community in the Midwest largely died in this region by the time of the Civil War. The religious revivalism that caught this place up and that made people more rigid in their beliefs and less open to each other, that made Ezra Cornell have to leave his congregation when he married a non-Quaker, that took over this place. And we've grown, we're the only upstate New York place to double in population since 1950. We're the only place upstate that's substantially grown, and it's largely in a time when people are privatistic and consumerist, although there's a strong small but vocal percentage here that bucks that trend, and it helps to contribute to what our presence is in the wider world. But we still struggle, and you have found a wonderful community. And when I asked people, who should I meet that is living a simple life and who's not ashamed of it, who's proud of being able to do what they do and share it with others, your name came up from three people, and that's powerful. And they know you through the congregation, and they knew that you would be right for this show.
Well, that's great to hear. I guess I am meeting some friends and joining some networks of people. Yeah, that was one reason that I took that job and continue to work with that job, and also to work with the co-op. I have a weekly super worker shift, and so I've gotten to know people in the co-op by having a working role.
Green Star, the Green former Star. Ithaca Real Food Co-op back in the day.
Right.
Yeah.
And I also found a niche at the State Theater as a volunteer usher.
Yep.
And all of those positions have contributed to my sense of belonging in this community, which was quite a challenge, I have to say. After living in the Duluth area for 27 years and being a radio personality for some of those years, and then being connected with Carla, who was also in the public limelight, to be turning around and finding a stranger every time I heard the word David on the street. I was accustomed to finding somebody to greet me or ask me to stop for a cup of coffee or something. It was a tremendous contrast to be unknown in an area in my new home after I had been well known.
I get it. I get it. One of the things that you may know or may not, but for example, for the last 20 years, almost none of the housekeeping staff at Cornell is able to live in Tompkins County because they don't have the incomes to afford the housing prices here.
Right.
And so, and as a consequence, people don't really know each other because they don't live shoulder to shoulder. They don't see each other outside of work times, and they work different hours. And we are an amazingly diverse community, but we don't know each other. And it takes the kind of chutzpah, the kind of guts to get out there and engage with people that you have to get to know each other and to become known and admired. And also, I would imagine, from time to time, challenged, because people here are not shy about their challenges either.
Mm-hmm.
So, good.
Right.
But what do you have next for us on the lineup?
I guess that's why we live in Tioga County, and that's part of the reason that I feel so disconnected from WRFI. We can't hear it.
You can't hear it, yeah. And you and Tioga County offers the largest stream of commuters into Tompkins County of any of the surrounding counties. But a third of our workforce, 20,000 permanent workforce, not students, a third of our workforce commutes into the county from outside, mostly because they can't really afford to live here. And that includes professionals with jobs that I see in other places who come in at beginning wages, but they can't afford to buy into the housing market.
Well, that's really interesting.
So it's a huge issue. We are a region. We are not a county. We are not a town or city. We are a region, and we haven't come to terms with that. Same way with your bees, I would imagine, too. It's a regional issue, a larger issue.
Right.
So what music do you have for us?
Okay, I have a song here called Solstice Flight. In the realm of being involved with people, Carla and I have some holidays that we enjoy celebrating, and we like to throw a party. And we just had a solstice party for the summer not very long ago. And the solstice has always been a meaningful experience for me, whether it be winter or summer. And so this song reflects some of that. The green hills, red and golden, and then the bay becomes a field of ice. Seasons turn unfolding. Light of day, dark of night. We are the children of this earth. We are creatures of the sky. Spinning through the universe. This is not imaginary flight. Flying through the moonlight, or through the Milky Way, out among the shooting stars, dancing with the northern lights. And geese call as they fly by. You'd think they were leading us through the stars to dance with the lights of the northern sky. And we'll dance while the flames grow higher. And now we'll light the torches and light the bonfires. And let the flames leap high, and let the fires blaze. A call for the sunrise, before the daybreak,
The sunshine, the call, the light. Ours is a small, fragile earth. We are a speck in the galaxy. There's magic in the dark and in the light. More than we can see.
Guest is David Hopkins, and that was Solstice Flight. David, it's great to have you on the show this morning. One of the places that I like to go towards the end of the show is, it kind of picks up a little bit of the theme of your Solstice Flight and the notion of rejuvenation of the seasons. One of the things that I think people, we don't talk to each other enough about in this world, what do you do to take care of yourself? What do you do to restore your sense of balance and your optimism when things take it apart? And when I ask that, I'm not looking for some vague generality. I'm looking like, you know, what do you do to help your mind, to help your heart, to help your body daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, whenever? What do you do? What do you practically do to restore yourself?
I do a lot of self-talk, I guess. I sometimes speak right out loud to myself and remark on my behavior, take a second to question my thinking or my speaking, and give myself a reminder via the mechanisms of self-talk and talking to myself. I think that's my primary mode.
Mm-hmm.
Although music and writing are part of that same business.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're the first person I've ever interviewed. I've done 120 or 130 of these interviews who said self-talk. And I actually grew up in a culture where it was common for people to talk to themselves. And that self-narration of what they were doing and commentary on what they were doing was just kind of... In my generation, it was regarded as kind of quaint and old-fashioned, but and people since have forgotten it for the most part. But it was a powerful way that they kind of kept track of things without having to bottle everything up.
Right, right. Something happens when I speak out loud. I can remind myself. If I'm doing some carpentry and saying, that's 2 1/4 inches, I'll remember much better if I speak it out loud.
If you
2 1/4 for that, 3 1/2 for this. Then I can remember it for like 10 seconds before I have to come back and check again.
Right, right, right. And for me, if I say it, if I write it, and if I see it.
Yeah.
And then I physically do it. Then I know it. I got it. I own it on some level, you know. But I have to work my body and my mind and my heart in all those different ways to really learn something and to hold on to it.
Right.
It's powerful. So What else? You're talking about raising a garden, too. You're talking about working with your hands and your body and doing carpentry. How does that and being a janitor, that's physical work. We don't build, in general, in this culture, we don't build our exercise into our daily lives through our physical work.
Right.
You know what I mean? But you seem to do that, and I don't even know if you own it.
I do. I usually pass on taking a walk for the sake of exercise. Because I'd rather sit down and rest for a while. I'm pretty active. I'm pretty physical from the time, from all day long. I put on a lot of miles,
right.
Up and down steps. I lift heavy things and move things around. I'm pretty physical. Gardening and beekeeping is heavy and physical work. And I'm in the fifth year now of remodeling our barn. So I'm active in carpentry and setting up scaffolds and ladders and up and down and moving materials around and all of that sort of thing. So
yeah.
I am very physical.
Yeah, yeah. David, it's been really good to get to know you.
Thanks, Eric.
And what are you going to close us with today? Because we just got a couple minutes left.
I think I'll close with a song of mine that I had to learn for one of my recent birthday parties. I actually had a birthday party because of this song. I like to throw a birthday party when I turn the decade, but then this came along and I thought, man, I better hire a band, see if they'll let me play along with them. When I get old, I'm losing my hair. Many years from now, will you still be sending me a valentine, a birthday greeting, a bottle of wine? If I've been out till a quarter to three, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? I could be handy mending a fuse when your lights have gone. You can knit a sweater by the fireside, a Sunday morning to go for a ride. Doing a garden, digging the weeds, who could ask for more? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Every summer we can rent a cottage in the Isle of Wight. If it's not too dear, we shall scrimp and save. Grandchildren upon your knees, Vera, Chuck and Dave. Send me a postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view, indicate precisely what you mean to say. I'm yours sincerely wasting away. Send me an answer just to fill in a form, mine forevermore. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Send me a postcard to drop me a line, stating point of view, indicate precisely what you mean to say. I'm yours sincerely wasting away. Give me an answer, fill in a form, mine forevermore. Would you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This has been the Made of Clay Report, and our guest has been David Hopkins.